Good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this Tuesday morning. I hope everybody is doing well out there in Southeast Kansas and Northeast Oklahoma. And joining us on the line right now is Attorney General Derek Schmidt. Good morning, Mr. Schmidt. How are you doing today, sir?
Well, good morning. Doing great. Hope everybody's doing well at home.
Oh, absolutely. Doing good here today. It's going to be another beautiful day here in Southeast Kansas. And let's go ahead. A few topics that I would like to throw your direction. And one of the things that you've been talking about is going to create basically something to protect privacy and civil liberties during the COVID-19 contact tracing, correct?
Well, right. I mean, there's so much going on with the pandemic management and everything, the government response that's accompanied it, which is a whole different story. But, you know, one of the sort of basic things that the public health folks all tell us, and they have from the start, is that if you want to manage the spread of a contagious or infectious disease like COVID, one of the things you have to do is when you figure out somebody has been exposed and is infected, you need to try to figure out who that person has come into physical contact with so that you can then tell them, hey, you've been in proximity to somebody who was infected. It would be a good idea if you monitor yourself for symptoms, take some extra precautions, maybe self-quarantine for a while so that you don't further spread the disease. This is different from mandatory quarantines, which are enforceable under Kansas law and have been since at least the early 20th century, so for more than 100 years. But this is a different issue. This is just the simple concept of if you know somebody is sick and they've come in contact with somebody else, you need to be able to figure out who that somebody else is so you can tell them, hey, you may want to take some precautions. And the public health people point out that we've been doing that as a society since the plague was in Europe hundreds of years ago. It's a standard practice that's used in managing contagious and infectious diseases. The issue is that while all that is true, it also is true that this is the second decade of the 21st century and that the tools available to public health officials or anybody else, and the anybody else part is important, to try to monitor contacts, one person to another, who I've been in contact with, close to, in proximity with, are much different than they were even 10 years ago, much less, 100 years ago when the Spanish flu ravaged the country and the globe. Now we all carry cell phones and they all have location identifiers. And, literally with the touch of a button, so to speak, it's possible to tell if, for example, you and I have been within 6 or 10 feet of each other because our cell phone Bluetooths talk about that. And even now, two of the major tech companies, Apple and Google, have been very open, very proud about the fact that they're developing a COVID tracing technology that people can use in order to figure out whether they've been close to somebody whose phone, Bluetooth marker, says, hey, this person is positive. And there are also a whole bunch of other entities out there. Of course, as with anything, there's the legitimate users, and there are issues with that, and then there are the bogus users. We're in the process of engaging right now with Apple and Google, not on the issue I just described, but on the related issue that in their Play Stores and their Apple Store, where you can go in and download apps, there are a bunch of apps that are just developed by random private entities. They market themselves as COVID tracing apps. People use them. Some people choose to do this. But it turns out that they're really about data collection for marketing purposes and not for public health. So you get the idea. My point is there are lots of issues connected to this one simple phrase of contact tracing, and understandably, a lot of people are concerned about that. So one of the things we've done, we've really engaged with our legislature and the governor, and we've said, look, at least there need to be some rules of the road. There was no law in Kansas governing any of this until about 2 weeks ago. But the legislature, to their credit, enacted a statute, the Contact Tracing Privacy Act. It's law in Kansas now. The governor signed it as part of the COVID relief bill. And at least now it sets out some basic common sense rules. For example, if the government's going to engage in contact tracing, whether it's fancy stuff with high tech or whether it's the old-fashioned, knock on somebody's door or pick pick up the phone and say, hey, we think you've been close to somebody, physically close to somebody who we now know has been infected. You might want to take cautions. There are now limits on that. There are limits on the questions that can be asked. There's a requirement that any information collected, who you've been in touch with, have you been close to Sally or Bobby, you know, because we know that they've been sick. That information has to be kept strictly confidential. That information cannot be used by the government for any purpose other than for the contact tracing itself. And when the pandemic is passed, all of that has to be destroyed. That information has to be purged and destroyed. And if the government fails to do that, or any individual contact tracer person working for the government fails to do that, they can be subject to either civil penalties or, in some cases, it can be a crime. So, you know, that's a lot of words, but you boil it all down. We've got this old, tried and true system that public health officials use. We've got these new technologies and the widespread use that makes people very nervous about privacy and civil liberties. And Kansas now has become the first state pass a law that says if you're going to do the old public health things, you have to do them in a way that respects civil liberties and privacy in the 21st century. We think that's good.
Absolutely. I do think it's a great idea as well. Just kind of keeping up with that. And also kind of staying with the COVID-19, topic, you know, last week or a couple weeks ago, the special session House Bill 2016 was signed into law, which one of the things it does concerning COVID-19 is decriminalizes violations of the governor's emergency orders. I just want to know your thoughts on that.
Well, I think it's a good thing. You know, the Emergency Powers Act and the governor's emergency orders have received a lot of attention. I've got mail and email on both sides. You know, people who wonder why the state allowed the governor these extraordinary powers, and at the other end of the spectrum, people who wonder why anybody would ever question their use. And I suppose that's all a function of people being scared and our lives being disrupted, and this is a really unusual circumstance. But here's kind of been the bottom line for me. We have a tried and true Emergency Powers Act in Kansas. Governors have used it now for about 40 years, 45 years. We need it whenever there are floods or fires or tornadoes or disease outbreaks, because things have to happen quickly that ordinarily wouldn't happen in order for folks to remain safe. Nobody really disagrees with that principle. But it's also true that there's a big difference between a governor entering an order that says, hey, don't go within the perimeter of the town of Greensburg because it was just wiped out by a tornado and there might be looting. And if you cross this circle, this line around the town, we're going to arrest you. That's one thing. Quite a different thing for a governor to use exactly the same authority, the same legal authority, to say, hey, don't open your barber shop because you might make somebody sick, even if there hasn't been a confirmed case of community spread of the disease in your town, and the people whose hair you're cutting are all from your town, and you've been cutting their hair for 20 years, and none of them are sick. Now, those are extreme examples, but they illustrate the point that one size doesn't fit all in this. So I think it was a really good thing. The legislature finally decided, here's what we're going to do. We're just going to say it's not a crime to violate these governor's orders anymore. Now, it doesn't mean you're free to thumb your nose at them. There's still a consequence for violating the orders, but the consequence is that an enforcement official, county attorney, district attorney, or the attorney general, can go before a judge and say, hey, this person is violating the governor's order, and we want you, judge, to order them to stop. That is very different from saying a violation is a crime, and any law enforcement officer on his or her own authority may arrest somebody for opening their business or going to church or whatever it may be, leaving their homes, literally, in some cases. So the legislature's really tried to tailor the response to the need, and I really commend them for that. I think it was a thoughtful approach.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think you said it a month ago when we last talked that, you know, I mean, you can't do a one-size-fits-all, because you got some counties out in western Kansas that they have no cases at all. So how does that fit them when, I mean, you'll have another county that has, say, like 100 cases? Those are two totally different situations. And I agreed when Governor Kelly took out the phasing plan to make it on a county-by-county basis, because I think that fits a little bit better than just a cover statewide. Your thoughts on that?
I think that's right. And, you know, the numbers have started to tick back up now in a handful of counties, about 8 or 10, I think it is. I may be a little off on the number, Sedgwick being the biggest one. And, you know, some of those counties have really eased things up, and they're starting to see more community spread. But that's not the most awful thing that can happen. I'm not saying it's a good outcome. I'm just saying you got to trust people. It's not the case that if the government doesn't have this sort of central command saying thou shalt all statewide do this way, that it's just a terrible outcome. Topeka is not the only fount of wisdom in this state. And, leaders in Wichita or Coffeyville or Goodland also, A, can be trusted to be responsible, and B, need to have skin in the game. We're all in this together, and it's not the deal where one person or one small group of leaders in Topeka get to say, here are the rules, thou shalt do this, and anything else is error. So I do think we're moving in the right direction.
I agree with you there, sir. And one of the last things I do want to talk about, that the state of Kansas has filed a third lawsuit alleging antitrust price fixing against the generic drug industry.
Yeah, this hasn't gotten as much attention as I might have expected. I'm not complaining. I'm just a little bit surprised. It's kind of a big thing. We've now, for about the past 3+ years, almost 4 years, we've been engaged in litigation with most of the major drug manufacturers in the country and some that are offshore, who make generic drugs, the non-branded drugs. Of course, generics are supposed to be on the whole cheaper than branded drugs. Something goes, once the branding period ends, then the price tends to go down, and that's a very good thing in terms of making medicines more affordable to people who need them. The issue is we found pretty good evidence that many of these generic drug companies were engaged in illegal price fixing. They were talking with each other and figuring out how to carve up the market, minimize competition, and keep the price of generics higher than they otherwise would have been. And that's illegal under both Kansas and federal law. So we've now filed a series of 3 lawsuits. We filed the first about 3.5 years ago, and we filed the third just a couple of weeks ago. And we have sued literally hundreds of defendants, most of the major manufacturers of generic drugs. And we'll see how it gets ultimately sorted out. But we think it's a strong case, and we think ultimately this is about making sure the marketplace functions to drive down prices for consumers who want to use generic drug products and should be saving more money than they currently are because the companies have fixed the prices. So hopefully we'll get some relief on that.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you on that. I have to take a maintenance drug pretty much the rest of my life, and I get the generic version of it. So I definitely need the cheaper price on that for sure. Well, Mr. Schmidt, I appreciate you taking a few minutes out of your time today to talk to us. Well, we definitely appreciate it, and we will talk to you again next month. And again, be safe out there, sir.
Thank you. I'll look forward to it. Good day, everybody.
All right. Thank you very much. That is Attorney General Derek Schmidt talking to us today, and we appreciate him coming on every month, the third Tuesday of every month. So I enjoyed talking to him today. A few topics there. We'll have the interview up on our website here in just a few moments, but until then, we are going to go ahead and take a break. But when we come back, we will have, at the top of the hour, we will have some Fox News and then some local news with Connor Harbutt, and then Lisa Wilson from the Chamber of Commerce of Independence. She will be in studio and talking about several events going on around Independence. So again, keep it locked here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Also, Open Line will be starting later today around 8:40. We'll take your calls if you have anything you wanted to buy, sell, trade, or give away. You're listening to the Mighty 690.